Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Millions of Canadians use dating apps, presumably looking for love or at least companionship that they might hope will mean they don't need a dating app any longer. But a lawsuit launched in the U.S. recently accuses two of the most used platforms, Tinder and Hinge, of having a predatory business model that keeps users swiping and paying. With us now on the merits of such criticism, including whether apps gamify dating, we're joined in New York, New York, by Pani Farvid, who is Associate Professor of Applied Psychology and Founder and Director of the Sex Tech Lab at the New School. And in San Francisco, California, Dr. Anna Lemke, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University and author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Anna, I'm going to start with you. Apps such as Hinge and Tinder have been accused of employing manipulative behavior. How can dating apps psychologically affect users?
Well, what we see clinically in a subset of individuals is that they initially go on the apps in the hopes of meeting somebody special in their lives. But what happens is that their engagement turns into an end in itself, which is to say their interactions and the effort of finding somebody becomes so reinforcing for them that it ends up occupying all of their time, energy, creativity, attention, totally independent of actually making any kind of meaningful connections. So that the medium itself becomes the sort of object of their desire, which, you know, the definition of addiction is the continued compulsive use of a substance or a behavior despite harm to self and or others. And so the harm comes in terms of things like opportunity costs, where an enormous amount of time is spent on the dating app as an alternative to other things that person might be doing. It's interfering with their self-care, like their ability to sleep, their ability to exercise. So that's the kinds of things we see that are damaging.
All right, Pani, you do some research on this, the intersectionality of technology and intimacy. I would say for some people, it's a new world. For others, it might be the only world that they know. How does it relate to the accusations against Match Group, which is the parent company and the owners and operators of those said websites, Hinge, Tinder, OkCupid?
Well, it's interesting because there's sort of a real contradiction in terms with regards to both the business plan of a business, particularly technologically mediated businesses that are interacting with individuals via social media or any other kind of platforms in the contemporary kind of hyper-capitalist US or Western context or global context. You are seeking to engage users and have algorithms, platforms, and mechanisms that keep the user engaged. And given that the ostensible promise of certain apps is for you to meet a significant other, if that's what they're offering. Of course, there's much more on offer than that. That's a contradiction in terms of with regards to the business plan and what is on offer. So I think one of the things that's really important to keep in mind is that our everyday lives are increasingly technologically mediated, particularly the way in which we socialize with others. And that this is a consideration that we need to think about both with regards to intimacy and dating apps, but also beyond. And really being aware and a bit more savvy and a bit more kind of socially engaged or socially aware that, you know, many of the ways in which such apps, you know, provide a new way for many people to make intimate connections there are also very profound ways in which the algorithms, the affordances, the ways you are invited to use them are set up using psychological knowledge around what creates return engagement, what creates a deeper engagement and an ongoing engagement.
All right, we'll delve into that. But before we do that, I want to get into some data. According to Statistics Canada, in 2018, approximately 1.9 million people were using dating websites or apps. In 2020, that number grew by a million users to 2.85 million. In 2022, we saw that almost double to 3.46 million Canadians. Pani, I'm going to come back to you. As we've seen, using technology to meet new people is increasingly popular, especially amongst young adults. I will admit, looking at those numbers, I imagine it's maybe a bit skewed. Maybe it's downplayed. There may be people who might feel like they're embarrassed. Maybe there is a little bit of stigma or embarrassment in using apps still. But do you see this trend continuing to grow?
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic and really interesting issue to think about. And I think one way to kind of contextualize it is, A, thinking about the ways in which our lives and intimacy have in many ways always been technologically mediated, whether it's the advent of the train, the telegram, the automobile. But that when it comes to online dating has existed like in the PC format since the mid-90s, basically with the advent of the internet. But what was interesting and what's different between dating apps and traditional online dating is online dating was heavily stigmatized and had a very slow uptake for a number of years. What really changed the game was when dating apps moved from the population of men who have sex with men and Grindr that was introduced in 2009 to the introduction of Tinder in 2012. By 2014, dating apps as a concept, as a avenue to seek intimacy, was mainstreamed and also extremely attractive to demographics across the spectrum. Young, mostly used by young folks, but young, old, gender variant, sexually fluid.
All right. Anna, I want to bring you in. Pani was mentioning so much of our lives these days has to do with some sort of device in our hands and our necks sort of bent down and, you know, our whole lives are essentially there. What effect does digital dating have on our socialization?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that it's not all bad, right? I mean, this is really the way that people meet other people, especially young people now. What I find really interesting is even among a college campus community like here at Stanford, where you would think that there's a lot of opportunities to go out and meet people in person, you wouldn't need a dating app. A lot of young people in college still use them because it's a way to signal to other people that you are available and you're interested in meeting somebody. So, I think it's important to acknowledge that the genie's out of the bottle. We're not going back.
We're not going back. Are there going to be bar dates or blind dates set up by friends anymore? Do those still exist?
You know, it'll all still probably exist in some form mediated by the technology. I just think, you know, folks today are cybernetically enhanced to some degree or another, and it's a part of our world. So the key here is really when the use of the app to meet somebody for the purpose of establishing some kind of relationship gets contorted into using the app to have some kind of emotional reaction. And to understand this, we really need to appreciate what's happening neurobiologically in the brain, which is to say, we are wired over millions of years of evolution to want to make human contact. The reason that falling in love feels good is because it releases dopamine, our reward neurotransmitter, in the reward circuits of the brain, which is the same circuit that's stimulated by drugs and alcohol. So, we are wired through evolution to meet people because we're social creatures. And when we're living in groups, we do better than when we're isolated. The problem with the dating apps is they've taken this fundamentally healthy human drive and distilled it down into its most addictive reinforcing components. And they've done that by certain features. So for example, the likes that you get, those are sort of primers that in and of themselves probably also release dopamine in the reward pathway, so that it just feels good to get a like, independent of whether or not that like is actually going to move you toward your professed initial goal for using the app, which was to meet another human being. It might be that the app just becomes a way to get the little likes, to get that hit of dopamine, to feel good. Likewise, the push notifications, very similar type of thing. They disrupt or interrupt what we're doing otherwise. They probably, in a Pavlovian style, release a little dopamine, distract us, and then set us up for a state of craving where we then need to go onto the app to see what came in to fulfill that state of craving. So the point being, it's they're addictive by design, which for the majority of people will not necessarily lead to a dating app addiction, just like the majority of people who drink alcohol will not get addicted to alcohol. Most people will realize, hey, there's a problem here, and they'll self-correct. They'll get off the app, or they'll find ways to use it less. But there will be a subset of people, of vulnerable individuals, for whom those dating apps will act like a powerful and potent drug and will interfere with their ability to actually, you know, create thriving, meaningful, positive relationships that benefit them in their lives.
Very good. Pani, I want to come to you. Let's use, I'm going to say Hinge's slogan, which is designed to be deleted. Now, the lawsuit cites that it's accusing them of doing the opposite. Do you think dating apps are keeping people single?
Yeah, that's a really interesting marketing campaign. And it's, I think it's successful most likely because it's very contradictory to kind of what one imagines the business model would be for a dating app. I think it's a really complex issue and situation, and I really want to kind of like draw on that notion of what we've just been talking about, that our desire for connection and intimacy can sometimes be satiated by this sort of like thin intimacy or, pretend intimacy through the engagement with the app, where you haven't actually met, you need some kind of social connection, but you haven't actually met anyone and created a deep connection. There's a thin intimacy going on, or kind of like a emotional pacifier or intimacy pacifier in that moment. And we've certainly seen this in our research. Folks, you know, do use dating apps sometimes to like ease boredom or have a sense of connectivity, and not to undermine the fact that having connectivity in an online format is still connectivity, but it certainly isn't in-person connectivity. And one of the surprising findings from much of our research is that dating apps have not replaced the desire to meet in person. And that is the final vetting process, for better or worse. And so if it's impeding one's capacity to meet others in person, and that's the goal that you have, there is a disruption happening. And that is something that we need to look at further.
All right, let's talk about how we can protect users. Anna, how can regulators and policymakers address concerns about these alleged predatory business models and manipulative features that you had mentioned in digital dating apps to ultimately protect the people who use them?
Well, I think first of all, we have to think about kids and kids' safety and making sure that there aren't predatory practices, especially targeting kids. We do see that, again, clinically, teenagers going on these apps, underage, and being preyed on by older individuals or just adults who misrepresent themselves. So that's super important. We really need to create robust policies to make sure that the age limits for these apps are enforced. And then, you know, like all digital media, we have to look at the inherent design features that make them more reinforcing beyond the purpose for which they were intended. And I think just also a lot more education. for people in general, that just how these tools are, you know, potent when they're used as tools, but also really quite dangerous when they're used as drugs, and the ways in which, again, the medium itself can be addictive, and really educating people about what's going on and helping them see that aspect of it.
Pawnee, you talked about sort of the business model here. How much responsibility actually do you think lies on the developers of these apps, who at the end of the day are running a business, versus the users themselves?
Great question. And I think one of the things that's been fascinating for us is doing some research during COVID, looking at what mobile dating was like during that time. We were able to identify that a lot of dating apps were actually being very community-minded, that they quickly switched into action and were feeding users with a lot of messages around, make sure you're responsibly dating. They added new affordances to their app so that you could, you know, video chat within their, you know, particular dating app. And I think one of the things that's become really clear, especially for our work that really tries to look at the ethics of dating apps and who is having a safer time on dating apps and who are having more challenging time, we are really aware that apps could be doing a lot more, or the creators and the folks who run this, a lot more when it comes to the safety and well-being of their users. They just don't, because we don't demand that of them. Mm. And there isn't as much of a fallout that they expect. I think with COVID, you know, there was perhaps, I'm speculating, a concern that no dating app wanted to be in the news media being seen as a app that was a super spreader. And I think, you know, we have to think about, you know, the harms that apps can do for people, or some of the ways in which other types of harassment occur. Those are sort of super spreaders of, you know, unethical and inappropriate conduct. And so both the addictive components and the harmful behaviors on dating apps need to be more deeply addressed by the business models of the dating apps itself.
All right. Anna, you had mentioned and said the word addiction. I'm curious, in terms of some pointers for individuals who want to maintain healthy boundaries and self-regulation while using dating apps, what words of advice do you have?
Well, I think just in our own awareness about our behavior, thinking about what we call the three C's: control, compulsions, and consequences. So control refers to using more than we planned or intended, or having difficulty cutting back. With dating apps, this would look like just spending more time on the dating app than we planned or intended, and doing that repeatedly, or having difficulty getting off the dating app when we want to and need to. Compulsion refers to a lot of our mental real estate occupied with thinking about the app, kind of a narrowing of our focus on that one activity. And then, of course, the classic sort of sine qua non for addiction, which is the continued compulsive use despite harm to self and or others. So really looking for ways in which our potential preoccupation and use of a dating app is interfering with our ability to care for ourselves, our ability to treat other people the way that they should be treated, opportunity costs, again, other things that we're not doing. Also, a soft sign of addiction, which I find very useful, although you won't find it in any textbook, is sometimes what we call the double life, which is to say the lying that goes on around addictive behaviors. So I would say to an individual, if you find that you are now using a dating app in a way that you're lying about, or that you would feel reluctant for somebody else to look on your phone and see what you're doing on your phone, and that's inconsistent with your values, you might worry about developing a kind of compulsive overuse phenomenon.
All right, I have a couple of minutes left, and I have two questions, one each. Pawnee, let's talk about sort of the societal and cultural factors that contribute to the challenges of navigating intimacy in relationships. Because I will admit, speaking anecdotally, all of my friends and colleagues who talk about their dating life and sort of going on websites and navigating have a challenge. And some people don't even talk about it as well, because I'm sure there's other challenges there as well. But walk us through us. What are some of the challenges there?
So I don't want to get alarmist, but I do think, you know, as a society, as a global society, we're feeling under a lot of existential threat right now from multiple domains. I think all sorts of things are happening within our broader collective society that are, A, challenging even like the libidinous desire to kind of engage in the pursuit of romance, intimacy, and those sorts of things. So I think that we should think of this kind of at that higher, like, philosophical, humanistic level. And then secondly, I would say, you know, on a practical level, you know, in hyper-capitalist, increasingly busy, complex social cultural context, it becomes harder and harder to create social connections ad hoc or by chance and or through friends and family, like more collectivist cultures and or we used to do in previous generations and previous times. And I think, you know, to build on what Anna was saying, we do know that psychologically, social connection, human connection, doesn't have to be just intimate connection, is so important to our health and well-being, that I think one takeaway from this, from me, would be work really hard in building solid, intimate, social and interpersonal connections that don't necessarily have to be sexual or romantic, but really developing a solid core sense of belonging and community wherever you are and however you can.
Anna, I'm just going to get you to add on that with your final words, you know, in terms of how we navigate the digital dating age with, you know, yes, with this lawsuit, but just for the future of romance and companionship and sort of life.
Well, one of the things that I recommend often is something we call the abstinence trial or a dopamine fast, which is if we're engaging in something like a dating app and we're wondering if it's doing more harm than good, to just stop using it for a period of time. We usually recommend about 4 weeks as a way to get enough distance from it to be able to see whether or not it's achieving what we want it to achieve or whether, in fact, it's doing more harm than good. So, you know, not speaking broadly to the world of romance in the 21st century, but just specifically on dating apps, you know, I know many, many people use them. I know many people find them helpful. But if you're wondering if it really is helping you, then maybe give it up for a month and notice, you know, pay attention to whether or not you experience actual withdrawal from using the dating app. The universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance are anxiety, irritability, dysphoria, craving. And then importantly, as Pani said, really focus on trying to establish connections with the people that you meet in person in your real life every day.
Some sound advice. Anna, Pani, thank you so much for joining us on the program tonight.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.